You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 4th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
That's a short list this week.
Oh, what the hell?
I don't remember the last time the list was this short.
Yeah, Kara is traveling. I think she's in Africa or on her way to Africa at some point.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
And Jay had a work thing. He probably will be joining us later in the show, hopefully, but that's always unpredictable when you're dealing with a work event. And Definitely. We have an interview later in the show with Pamela Gay, so she'll be joining us as well, so we won't be so lonely later in the show, guys, but for the beginning part, it's just the three of us.
Oh, and then there were three.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the big news this week that we have to mention is the largest mass shooting in modern American history that happened on Sunday night in Las Vegas. Just stunning, you know, just so sad. The shooter opened up with converting a semi-automatic into fully automatic weapon, just sprayed a crowd of, I think there was something like, did they say 22,000 people
goers.
At a country concert, outdoor concert across the street, and just indiscriminately sprayed the crowd, killed 58 people is the latest count that I heard, wounded 500. 500
plus.
Wounded. Some of them may die. You know, some of them are critical. And then killed himself as the police were closing in. From, you know, again, there's still early reports as we're recording this in terms of motive. There doesn't seem to be any. I mean, that's a
big surprise to me, because there's really, but there's nothing. I mean, there seems to be nobody suspected it.
Yeah.
I did hear that he filmed some of it. So maybe he was talking while he was filming and revealing some of his motives. But otherwise, it seemed like a blank slate. Which is bizarre.
Yeah.
It's a big mystery right now. Obviously, the right authorities are looking into it, and there's a ton of speculation. This is a dangerous sort of time, in the sense that people are going to be forming some concrete opinions on not having all the facts. So we all need to kind of pause. I know it's been just horrible for the entire country. Not to mention the people directly affected by this, by every stretch. But it is also a time to just let's hold off for a little while and wait until we have more facts before we do start drawing any kind of real conclusions here.
Yeah, conclusions about this guy, about why he did what he did. And of course, we want to express our condolences to anyone who was touched by this. There's just so many people, obviously not just the people who were hurt and killed, but their families and people who know them, and you know the 6 degrees of separation you get to with an event like this is just amazing.
Oh, sure.
Like everybody knows somebody who knows somebody. It's just terrible. And of course, when events like this happen, you know the issue, the very controversial in this country issue of gun control has to come up. It is so depressingly predictable, though. You know the lines that get drawn. You know the political right, those who are against gun control or pro Second Amendment, however you want to say it, typically, and this is that came right out, you know, with these kind of sentiments saying, this isn't the time to talk about gun control. Don't politicize this tragedy. Of course, by doing that, they're politicizing it, you know?
Exactly.
It's so hypocritical. That is their political position. They don't want these events connected to gun control, of course, because they don't want the discussion to happen when people are focusing on it. They just want, you know, everyone to forget about it so it'll go away. Interestingly, in this case, it's not about, as far as we know, again, it's too early to know for sure, but there's no indication that there's any mental illness playing a role here. It's also a very frequent go-to. It's like, oh, well, this guy was obviously mentally ill, so it has nothing to do with anything else. Really wasn't the case here. And then, of course, a lot of people start talking about the effect of various gun control measures on the incidents and the risk of these sorts of events happening. And that's obviously, that's the only thing we really, as skeptics, that's our role, I think, is just to talk about the science, you know, not the politics of it per se, but just, well, what is the evidence?
And that's part of the problem, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah.
Because taking a scientific look at guns, at the effects of guns and gun violence, is actually incredibly difficult to do because you're shut down at almost every turn, right? I mean, isn't like that? There's that story we talked about months ago about the CDC wanted to just examine, do a scientific study about gun control or guns, and they were threatened with losing millions of dollars in funding, and they had to acquiesce and say, okay, we won't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, effectively banned from just studying as a public health issue, gun control measures or just gun violence, which is nonsense. I mean, you know, if you're trying to shut down research just because you don't want the results, I mean, that's clearly what they're saying is we don't want evidence-based policy. We want ideology-based policy. So no evidence.
Right.
We don't want the evidence. But the evidence that does exist is complicated, like as you might imagine. And that the complications allow for the potential to interpret it basically any way you want. So people will focus in on the subsets of the data that tell the story they want to tell and not look at the big picture and try to come to like a reasonable or objective opinion. It's more just driven by their ideology, which is, again, always disappointing. Unfortunately, I predict nothing will happen from this. That, you know, if killing 20 kids in kindergarten wasn't enough, I don't know how anything is going to be. So just, you know, the political will isn't there, and the ideological rhetoric is already so tight that they've, you know, basically effectively cut off any reasonable discussion about what even the things that the majority of Americans agree upon, including Republicans and Democrats, including NRA members, you know, like most people agree, we should have background checks for anyone who buys a gun, for example. And then even the things for which there is a strong bipartisan consensus, we can't get through. And that's, I think, the thing that I would like to see change. But no one knows how to do it. You know what I mean?
It's challenging because it is a Bill of Rights. It is the Second Amendment itself. And these are bedrocks that are very, very difficult, both in a political sense and in a legal sense, to chip away at. That's just how history has shaped up to this point. It's one of the biggest uphill battles that a political body can certainly face whenever you were talking about Bill of Rights issues.
Yeah, you know, I agree, although I don't think that the legal barrier is the big one, though. So sure, if you try to go too far, it could get struck down by the Supreme Court. But I don't think that's a limiting factor from where we are right now. It's more the political will. Like, again, there are certainly things like background checks that are, I think, would survive a Supreme Court challenge that, again, that most people want. And that probably is a good idea. You know, let's not let people who are mentally unstable or who, like, for example, are on a terrorist watch list, you know, buy guns. That seems to be reasonable.
See, they're reporting that the shooter was prescribed anti-anxiety medication this past summer. This is News Today.
Yeah.
Gunman purchased 50 10 milligram tablets of diazepam.
Mm-hmm.
Valium. Is that just kind of an outlier? Is that really an outlier? You can't make any sort of conclusion based on that?
It's not even a red flag. It's so common. It should not be stigmatized. It shouldn't put anybody in any kind of list. You know what I mean? That just, treating anxiety or treating depression or using sleep aids or whatever, that's so common. That doesn't mean that you're not a good citizen that can be trusted with guns. You know, we're looking more for a history of real behavioral instability, a history of violence. A history of domestic violence is a huge predictive factor, right?
Hmm.
So we're looking for predictive factors. Well, this guy had, you know, apparently by reports, this guy was a jerk to his girlfriend, but I don't know if that rises to the level of quote unquote domestic violence. Again, it's too early to really know what this guy's story was. But those are the kind of things you look for. You really don't want it. You don't want something like, oh, the guy's taking anti-anxiety medication to be a thing, because that's unfair. Mm-hmm. And that's not, doesn't mean that you can't be trusted to be a good citizen. So we need something that's more discriminating, more predictive, you know, and more just, if you're going to use any criteria in a background check, you know, to see like who should have the right to have. And also different kinds of guns may require different levels of background check or different whatever, different scrutiny. But this is getting, you know, this is where it all gets very, very controversial. But yeah, well, we're going to talk about it. You know, the people will talk about the evidence. People will distort the evidence. People will cherry pick it. And it'll go around in circles until everyone forgets about it and nothing will happen. That's almost certainly what's going to happen.
It adds more depression to the already depressing yeah. story that it is.
All right. That was, as I said, that was unfortunately the big news of the week. And to some extent in the news cycle has eclipsed what should have been the big news this week, which is the announcement of the Nobel Prizes.
Right.
We're going to be getting to those in a minute. But first, Bob, you were going to tell us about somebody who didn't win the Nobel Prize. You're going to give us another forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, this week for Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I will be talking about Martin Jim Aitken, 1922 to June 2017.
Oh, wow.
95, just a few months ago.
Good run.
Good run. He was a founding father of archaeometry.
What's archaeometry?
Archaeometry is essentially scientific archaeology. It's applying scientific techniques and technologies, specifically physics and mathematics, to the analysis of archaeological items. Aitken went to Wadham College in Oxford for physics. Wadham, W-A-D-H-A-M.
Yeah. Wadham.
Yeah.
But it was years later that the other shoe of his career dropped when in the 1950s his university opened up an archaeology department. He became the deputy director of the Research Laboratory for Archaeology at Oxford University. Now, much of his advances involved and much of his work involved dating objects, which, of course, is critically important when you're dealing with archaeology. So he and Edward Hall were instrumental in using proton-free precession magnetometers to find buried remains. He developed with Derek Walton the application of a SQUID in archaeology. Now, SQUID stands for a superconducting quantum interference device. That is essentially a cryogenic magnetometer, which can detect the subtlest of magnetic fields, like ancient geomagnetism, for example. It's sensitive enough to measure fields as low as, I believe, 5 times 10 to the negative 18 Tesla. That is tiny. The Royal Society said in Aitken's biography, it's largely through Martin's enthusiasm and that of Edward Hall that the Research Laboratory for Archaeology at Oxford led the way in science-based archaeology. So I love when I read that they wrote science-based blah, blah. I thought you'd like that one, Steve. Yeah. So remember Martin Jim Aitken. Mention him to your friends, perhaps when discussing archaeomagnetic prospection, or even flux gate magnetic gradiometers. And trust me, that's a real thing. That's a real thing, Steve. I thought of that flux capacitor stuff.
Yeah.
Or no.
It's almost technobabble.
It is. But it is. Flux gate magnetic gradiometers. They detect the drop off of magnetic fields. Just basically what the words are saying there. But when I read that, I was like, I'm so going to use that. That's awesome.
That will come up in conversation.
Oh yeah.
All the time. I've never heard of archaeometry. That word before, archaeometry.
No, I hadn't either.
And is it also? So it sounds like it's the application of technology to archaeology.
Yeah.
But is it also the application of like statistical science, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think any science that you specifically apply to it, I think you say that's archaeometry. It seemed to be a lot of Martin's focus seemed to be a lot of it, and not just the technology, but the physics and mathematics as well. Have you heard of astrometry, Steve? That's basically my understanding of that is essentially hyper precise measurements of things like distances and angles and stuff. Very ultra precise
astrometry. All right, so let's get right to the Nobel Prizes. This week was announced the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, Chemistry, and Physics. But actually, before we talk about the specific prizes, I do want to discuss a bit this article that was written in The Atlantic by Ed Yong, entitled "The Absurdity of the Nobel Prizes in Science." And he brings up some I think, valid points that are worth discussing. Essentially, you know, the Nobel Prizes are a bit archaic in the way that they're conceived. The two, I think, big weaknesses, if you will, of the Nobel Prizes. One is that the categories have just become narrow over time. You know, physiology or medicine is one, chemistry and physics. Okay, but that kind of asses out a lot of scientific fields, right? I mean,
tons.
Wait, would you say asses out?
Yeah, like what about?
Yes, you did.
I'd never heard that expression before.
You've never heard asses out?
You get asked out?
Really?
It's like unfairly cut out.
Yeah.
No, Wait, did it start with a G or just asses out?
Asses out.
Asses.
I hadn't heard of that.
A-S-S-E-S.
Evan, you've heard of that before.
Yes, I have.
Okay. I love asked it.
Out. You got asked out.
You got asked out. Yeah, so like, I don't know. would astronomy fit under physics? I mean, so you'd have to take like a broader view of these categories. Or like geology. Where would geology fit? Or earth sciences? Right. You know, archaeology. Nowhere, you know.
Paleontology, right.
Paleontology. Physiology or medicine, they kind of broaden that to include all the biological sciences, but even still, it really is, you know, geared towards human physiology and medicine, right? But that's a huge category. Is that really as big as chemistry? I don't know. It's hard to compare those two because they've had to broaden the physiology one so wide to include evolution, development, neuroscience, genetics. I mean, there's all these subfields. So anyway, I think, you know, whacking up the Nobel Prizes in science the way they do now, I mean, I don't think that's the way it would happen. If you were inventing a science prize now with different categories, I don't think it would be divided up this way. And so that they should, you know, in all honesty, I mean, I know it's got a really long history behind it, but they might consider modernizing it by recategorizing, you know, maybe coming up with more than three science categories and to figuring out a way to evenly divide up all of science into four or five categories, maybe.
I suppose that it depends on how much leeway, legally and otherwise, the committee has to make those kinds of significant decisions.
Know. I don't know.
Because it is the wishes of the will of Alfred Nobel by which the prize and all of this was originally established.
Oh, yeah,
so I'm not sure how true to the original wording of that document they have to remain, or they may be caged in. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine that they're caged in that tightly, but at the very least, they may have to reinterpret the categories. You know, like maybe chemistry should include all of earth science and physics should include astronomy, which it probably does. I mean, I think it includes astrophysics, but just straight
up
astronomy, I don't know. So anyway, they have to think about that. And then the other thing is, beyond the categories, is that, and this is kind of a good and a bad thing, in my opinion, that the Nobel Prizes have taken on such legendary status that it kind of diminishes all other scientific awards and prizes. You know what I mean?
I agree with that.
Like, you know, name one. Name a science prize other than the Nobel. You know, I know there's the MacArthur Medal. You know, there's...
How about Templeton, which is what? Science and religion.
Yeah, but, tough. Yeah. Oh, there's the Fields Medal. I mean, I can name a couple off the top of my head, but most people probably couldn't name any. You know, most just people in the public. So it creates this sort of dichotomy. It's like the Nobel Prize is everything and no other science prize really has any public awareness. And then beyond that, it puts Nobel laureates into this this status, which is, again, creates this false dichotomy between them and all other scientists. Like, if you don't have
a pantheon of
sorts. It's kind of ridiculous, you know, when you think about it. And, you know, then people just cite Nobel laureates as if they have this, you know, this mystic authority. And then if you're not in that category, you're nothing, you know. But also they have to choose no more than three scientists per category, and they have to be alive, which means they're going to draw arbitrary lines.
Einstein did not win a Nobel for relativity. Enough said.
Nope. Yeah.
Enough said. That is incredible. Incredible for these various rules and things. So
what I was talking about is that this is more true today than it was 100 years ago. You know, science is a team effort.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Like, so, like, as you'll see with some of the prizes we're talking about this week, where do you draw the line? Like, for any breakthrough, there could have been 20 or 30 people that meaningfully contributed to that, you know, field over the last 20, 30 years.
Exactly.
And you just pick three and then everyone else gets ignored. I mean, that's, you know, again, it's kind of artificial. It creates this false dichotomy, and people get asked out, again, to use that word, phrase.
The author Ed Yong in this article says that a recent paper which precisely estimated the mass of the elusive Higgs boson has 5,154 authors.
Mm-hmm.
So you have situations in which it's hundreds, it's potentially thousands of individuals worked as a team to come up with some incredible findings.
That's an extreme example, but you know, it would be nice if you could give it to 20 people. I mean, it's millions of dollars. It's not like there's not enough money to go around.
I don't know if there's a way for them to award it to sort of a trust or a foundation or something that is more encompassing of a group of scientists rather than the individual. I don't know if I'm not even sure what the right terminology would be to do that.
Or you can just give it to the individuals. I mean, there are. How about this? You could have primary and secondary awardees. It's beyond honorable mention. It's like, all right, here are three key people in this discovery, and here are 20 people, supportive researchers, who deserve to be mentioned and recognized and rewarded,
right,
who also get named.
So, yeah, so you could be a Nobel laureate, or you could be perhaps a Nobel Lilliputian.
Or whatever.
A Nobel Padawan.
Yeah, I've come up with some good term. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I do think the Nobel Prize needs a modernization in this way to better communicate how science actually works, to better recognize a broader scope of fields and the collective nature of modern science, whereas it's kind of frozen in time, you know, this 100-year-old award that has a reputation. Not that it doesn't deserve it, because it is a venerable award that is very, I think most of the time, they're very careful, and I think they're good in terms of who they give it to. But because of the archaic rules, it just doesn't reflect modern science, I think, optimally to deserve to be the only, you know, science prize that anybody knows the name of. You know what I mean? But I have no idea, Evan, getting back to your question, if this is even possible to change it, if it's locked in because of the will, how would we go about, you know, making these changes? It's interesting to think about that, but at least it'd be interesting to at least have the conversation.
There's a lot of secretiveness that goes on, obviously, in the selection process. And I imagine that a lot of the other affairs that take place among the committee and the business of running the Nobels also is shrouded in some secrecy. I don't know if they've maybe tried in the past to legally do some things in either a court or somebody protested and prevented them from doing so. We don't know. It's just there's a, I don't want to say taint of secrecy, but there's a overtone of secrecy that is also associated with the Nobels.
Yeah, like they don't reveal the nominees.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they don't reveal the internal discussion or the process. And I could see that to an extent. You know, it is what it is. And maybe it's just time that there are competing prizes that get more attention. But again, I think the Nobel just sucks all the air out of the room for any other science prize. And again, people in fields, in science, will know of other ones, like I mentioned a few, like the MacArthur Genius Grant or whatever. Mm. But so, yeah, there are other ones that are famous and people know about them, but not the general public. You know, again, I would bet that the only science prize the vast majority of members of the general public could name is the Nobel.
Hey, Joe Sixpack, for $1 million, name two famous science awards. Oh!
Okay, let's dig into the prizes themselves for this year. So I'm going to start with the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. And this one's actually pretty cool. I wrote about it on Neurological because I thought it was really interesting. So the prize goes to three Americans, Jeffrey Hall, not related to my friend who was on the show recently, Michael Rosbach and Michael Young, three researchers who contributed, again, along with a lot of other researchers who don't get named, to our understanding of the biological clock or how cells set their circadian rhythm. The circadian rhythm is the 24-hour biological rhythm that organisms have. And it turns out that biological clock, that circadian rhythm, is actually encoded in every cell. Did you know that?
Wow. That's amazing.
And every single multicellular organism has it. So this is something that has been highly conserved evolutionarily. And arose very early on in multicellular evolution.
What, the whole 24-hour day specifically?
Yep. I love this good old reductionist science where they find out the precise mechanisms of things. So we've actually known for a couple of hundred years that the circadian rhythm is not just responding to light levels. There was research done in the 18th century by astronomer Jean-Jacques Dortu de Meuron. I probably butchered that name. He studied mimosa plants, because mimosa plants open during the day and close at night. And he put them in a dark room and they still open during the day and close at night. So there was an internal rhythm. It wasn't just responding to light.
Good test.
But then it took a couple hundred years to figure out what is driving that internal rhythm. In the 1970s, Seymour Benzer and Ronald Konopka identified the gene in fruit flies. If you deactivated that gene, it would disrupt the circadian rhythm of the fruit flies. So it seemed that, okay, that gene seems to be critical. But now we get to the Nobel winners. So all three of them were involved in characterizing the period gene, which is the gene that regulates the circadian rhythm, and they identified and characterized the protein, the PER protein, that is produced by that gene. Further, they found that the PER protein increases while we're sleeping and then decreases while we're awake during the day.
Huh.
Over a 24-hour cycle. So clearly the rising and falling levels of this protein are somehow involved with the cycle. So then the question was, well, what's regulating the rising and falling of that protein level? And it turns out it's regulating itself. The protein, the PER protein, inhibits its own synthesis. So what that means is that the level of the protein will build up in the cell. When it gets to a certain point, it then turns off its own production. The protein is short-lived, so it degrades then over time. So the amount of it will decrease until it gets low enough that its production gets turned back on again, in which case it will increase again. Get it?
Cool.
So by inhibiting its own production from the cell, its own transcription from the gene, and because it degrades over time, that self-inhibitory feedback loop creates a cycle of increasing and then decreasing and increasing and then decreasing. So, but that leads to further questions, specifically, how does the PER protein inhibit its own synthesis? Because it actually would need to get into the nucleus, right? Because again, we're talking about multicellular creatures here. So Young specifically discovered a gene that he called the timeless gene, which makes a protein called TIM.
Sounds interesting.
That the TIM protein binds to the PER protein, and together they can enter the nucleus and inhibit the activity of the period gene. There's another gene that Young discovered called the double time gene, which makes the DPT protein, and this delays the accumulation of the PER protein, and so the amount of the DBT protein can tweak the duration of the cycle, could make it go longer or shorter.
Wow.
So there, all the elements are there. You know, what causes it to cycle, how it inhibits itself, and how it tweaks the duration. But there's more to this, because it just having this protein rising and falling over a 24-hour cycle isn't enough.
Yeah.
It has to actually do stuff, right? So one thing is there are proteins which link it to light so that it synchronizes with the day-night cycle. It's independent of it in that it happens even separate from light. So it's not just responding to light, but it does synchronize with the day-night cycle. And it's connected to a bunch of then other physiological functions. Once you have this little internal clock in all the cells, then you could evolve things that connect to it that then will also vary on a 24-hour cycle. So, for example, blood pressure, cortisol levels, body temperature, and alertness all also vary on a 24-hour cycle and are linked to rising and falling levels of the PER protein. So part of the reason why this was honored by the Nobel Prize is not only because this is a cool discovery about how cells work, but because it led to so much other downstream research. And again, that's sort of a good hallmark of, you know, of great science, is that it creates more questions than it answers, right?
Yeah, it opens up new frontiers.
The more people who are building research on what you did, then the more fundamental it is, the more interesting it is, the more useful it is, and those are factors that are worth recognizing. So this is a good one. I like this. Good story, good discovery, good science, definitely deserving of a prize. But again, kind of hard to draw the line at those three guys because there were so many other people who contributed.
So how bad are the health risks to a person who needs to fight against the circadian system?
The most common phenomenon that deals with that is shift work, right? So people who change what time of day they're awake and what time of day they sleep. And it's terrible. It just wreaks havoc. you know, with your sleep and then with lots of other things. So it is very unhealthy to engage in shift work. Jet lag is kind of a one-time short-lived version of that. I think most of us have experienced jet lag.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so you're sort of your internal clock is out of sync with external reality, you know, and it takes about a day per hour to sort of shift that, to resynchronize your internal clock with the time.
Do you think there's been, I don't know if this is the right word to use, a microevolution in the sense that humans have become such world travelers that generations have made an adaptation of some sort?
There's no evidence for that. I don't think there's been enough time really for us to have evolved significantly to adapt. Plus, it's also how many people travel enough that it's more than just an occasional inconvenience, you know?
It's probably a fraction of a percent.
Yeah. And then also, you know, once you raise your kids to independence, evolution is pretty much done with you at that point.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Another sad thought, yeah.
So that was a good one. Now, Evan, you're going to tell us about the Nobel Prize in Chemistry.
Yep. And this has been awarded to three scientists for their pioneering work in developing new methods of visualizing biomolecules.
Ooh.
Jacques Dubochet of Switzerland, Joachim Frank of the United States, and Richard Henderson of the United Kingdom. They were the three awarded the prize for cryo-electron microscopy.
Whoa.
Yeah. This is an excerpt from the official press release. Scientific breakthroughs often build upon the successful visualizations of objects invisible to the human eye. However, biochemical maps have long been filled with blank spaces because the available technology has had difficulty generating images of much of life's molecular machinery. Cryo-electron microscopy changes all of this. Researchers can now freeze biomolecules mid-movement and visualize processes that they have never previously seen, which is decisive for both the basic understanding of life's chemistry and for the development of pharmaceuticals. Cool. So the method means that, for example, molecules in a bacteria or in a virus can be examined under a microscope in their native undamaged state. And I think undamaged is sort of the key here.
And also in the act of doing something. You know, like if we're looking at a pore open or something or closed, we could freeze it in that state and study it that way. So it's not just its structure, but actually it's in a way we get some functional information about it too.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. The Nobel Committee Chairman Sarah Songrup Lintz had this to say. We're facing a revolution in biochemistry. Now we can see the intricate details of the biomolecules in every corner of our cells, in every drop of our body fluids. We can understand how they are built and how they act and how they work together in large communities. She also says, soon there are no more secrets. I don't know about that, but...
a little dramatic, you know, but yeah.
It does seem a little dramatic. But I don't know... I don't recall really a time in which we didn't have cryo-electron microscopy. Essentially, I have to go back many, many, a couple decades, I think, to remember a time of that. So much science since then has relied on this technology that, you know, where would we be without it?
Exactly. And we've mentioned on the show before the fact that sometimes the best scientific discoveries are not those that have a direct application in the world, but just make scientific research itself more efficient or faster or better or more detailed. You know, like the science of science itself. And when you improve that, then the downstream ripple effects can be massive. So this became a core technique for doing scientific investigation that led to just so many subsequent discoveries. Again, I think the Nobel Prize Committee takes that into consideration, the ripple effect of the research, you know, not just the finding itself.
Well, they said that in 2013, they were able to reach such atomic resolutions using this technology that researchers now routinely produce three-dimensional structures of biomolecules. So it's become, I suppose, commonplace, if I can use that term.
All right. That was cool, too. Okay, Bob, you're going to tell us about the Nobel Prize in Physics, which was simultaneously surprising and unsurprising, in my opinion.
Yeah, to me, it was maybe less surprising. But yeah, let's cover it. So congratulations to the 2017 winners of the Nobel Prize for Physics. That's Rainier Weiss of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Barry Barish and Kip Thorne. and Kip Thorne of the California Institute of Technology. They won the 2017 prize for their part in the discovery of gravitational waves, those ultra-tiny ripples in space-time, far smaller than a proton, that are caused by titanic events in the universe, like colliding black holes or Underwear Day at Jay's house. I will say no more. This one.
It's a real thing, oh, yeah. Folks.
This was a bit of a no-brainer in a lot of ways, Steve. I mean, this was a huge achievement. It created gravitational wave astronomy, a whole new field of astronomy. How often does that happen? Not often. It opened up a window to the universe that was a brick wall previously. We've been refining our abilities to catch and analyze things that are flung at us from space for centuries. You know, particles like cosmic rays and neutrinos, or the queen of space, light itself, electromagnetic radiation, in the form of visual wavelengths, infrared, X-rays, radio, gamma, etc. So, but all of that is essentially the same thing, you know, electromagnetic radiation traveling through space. Gravitational waves couldn't be more different. They're wiggles in space-time itself. And who knows, because this is such a new thing, like a new sense, a new window opening up on the universe, which is the metaphor that analogy that lots of people are saying. Who knows what we're going to find? I mean, besides, colliding black holes and neutron stars. Patrick Sutton, an astronomer at Cardiff University in Wales, said with the technology that the three developed, he said, we may even see entirely new objects that we haven't even imagined yet. And I mean, if any mature science can do that, then it's astronomy and this type of technology. I liked some of the quotes that the prize winners said. Barish told the AP, for example, this prize is a win for Einstein and a very big one. And I absolutely agree. I mean, this is, as if he needs even more vindication, but this is something that he predicted, over a century ago. I mean, this is huge. I mean, ripples in space-time, he was convinced that we would never, ever have the technology to actually see these things. And there they are. We're seeing them now. And Weiss said, I really liked his quote, and this harkens back to what we were previously talking about. Weiss said, I view this more as a thing that recognizes the work of 1,000 people. And that was a really nice thing for him to say. Because, many, many hundreds of people worked on this. But they have to single out people for a reason. I guess they don't have to, but they do. They single these people out for a reason. And they did have good reasons. Now, Thorne and Barish were tireless in their efforts to make this happen for years and years and years and decades. They've been trying to make this happen. So they get a quarter each of the Nobel Prize. Money, actually. Weiss, though, actually designed the laser interferometer device in the 70s. He designed the damn thing. He gets half the prize. And neat. I think that's deserved, too. That's the guy that really needs to be isolated and mentioned here, because he came up. This is the guy that created it, thought about it. He's the guy. And what a device LIGO is, a laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory. It is amazing. The most sensitive device ever created. When you have a device so sensitive, you have to account for things that you probably never would have ever considered. Like, for example, here's a couple of them that they had to actually deal with. The laser light wasn't perfect. It was damn close, but it wasn't perfect. There was slight imperfections, and that's because of fluctuations in the power grid. I mean, who would think that fluctuations in the power grid itself would need to be accounted for so that your signals wouldn't be completely masked or messed with? Or how about this? The jittering of individual atoms within the mirrors themselves. They had to take those little jittering movements into account. Otherwise, their data would be almost useless. Or distant lightning storms. They have to account for that. And there's a famous example of they had to account for like wolves in like the on the property of the facility, like outside, wolves walking around. They had to do that. And Weiss had a great quote. He's like, there are 10,000 other tiny things, and I really mean 10,000, and every single one needs to be working correctly so that nothing interferes with the signal. So this thing, it's a tour de force of technology and theory, and it's just it's an amazing thing, and I can't wait to see what we discover.
So the surprising thing to me was how soon it was awarded. Because the typically the Nobel Committee waits for years to lets a discovery simmer. And
so it is, it is evolving. It is changing. But I think what was critical in that decision then, Steve, would have been like three discoveries. They hit pay dirt three times with this technology. If they had only discovered one event, that initial event, and that was it, you would not have seen this prize for a little longer, I think. This is clearly, so successful, so obviously successful that they said, this deserves it at this point. Obviously,
it's not going to, I suppose it's not just not going to get better than this, than the LIGO.
Oh, well, actually, it is. Actually, it is going to get better. It is.
Is it?
Oh, my God. Yes. They're working on,
LIGO 2?
The super advanced LIGO. They're opening up more observatories in other parts of the world that are going to refine the measurements. They're going to have a space based version called LISA, which is going to be, amazing in and of itself. So, yeah, but that's more of a theme. That's a theme. It's going to be, more accurate, more things discovered, but there's nothing like that first time the concept is successfully pulled off, and then that's what deserves the Nobel Prize. And who knows, unless they use this technology to discover aliens, that might get its own Nobel Prize perhaps. But this is worthy, this initial discovery, even though it's going to go to amazing heights.
And not to take anything away from these nine scientists who I think deserve to be recognized for their research, but a lot of people have pointed out that, yet again, we have nine white guys, winning the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, which I think is partly a reflection of previous biases in who goes into science and who gets promoted
right.
and who gets, et cetera, et cetera. But also, we're not there yet, right? We're not at the parity, I think, where we should be. And
we're much better. We're much better than we used to be, but we still have a long way to go.
And I can't say that this played a role in any of this year's decisions, but people also want to have the conversation. Are there current biases in the way the Nobel is awarded?
Sure.
That leads to these kind of skewed outcomes.
And we know there's plenty of examples of people, of women that have been
historically,
left out.
Absolutely.
Some of them egregiously so.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
definitely.
Right. All right. No one wants affirmative action in something like the Nobel Prize. It should be awarded on merit, but we just have to make sure there's no biases, either latent or implicit or whatever biases in there.
Right, because we know biases do exist everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
We could do it like Project Runway, where the judges are judging the outfits without knowing who made them. It's like, okay, I'm going to look at the scientist's work. I don't know who did it. So the bias is completely removed. And of course, that's silly as hell because you can't,
you can't do it
like that. So I just said it to be funny. That's it. I'm done.
Okay. All right. Well, we have one non-Nobel related news item to close up this section. And this deals with our old friend, Elon Musk.
Elon.
Who just likes to make provocative announcements about what SpaceX and what he is going
to do.
He's
a provocateur, yes.
Nukes on Mars.
Right. So,
right. Bioengineer.
This time, the announcement that got everyone's attention was he said that he is going to develop rocket travel between cities on Earth. This is an interesting idea. It's, not a new idea. I've read about that decades ago in various different works of science fiction. You're traveling by rocket instead of airplane or jet. It has the advantage of being really fast. I mean, could you just go in like a suborbital arc, and you can get anywhere pretty quickly. He calculates that you can get to between almost any two cities on Earth. Obviously this is only going to be ones that are relatively far apart in about 30 minutes or less, right?
That's like,
could you imagine
incredible.
New York to Hong Kong in 30 minutes? Or, the longest trip we took was going to Sydney. We flew from New York to Sydney, either through Vancouver or through California. And that's basically, it takes you a whole day,
Oh, yeah. And some, talking about jet lag and circadian rhythms, you are messed up. For a while. So yeah, can you imagine just going to dinner? Yeah, I'll meet you at dinner tonight. I mean, how often do you drive for a half hour to go to a movie or dinner? I mean, you could, assuming the rocket is close to you, you could literally
Well,
something tells me it won't be cheap.
No, yeah, well, there's a lot of logistical questions. I mean, yeah, price is going to be the biggest one. Well, maybe you might argue safety would be the biggest one, but let's assume they can get it to be really safe. It would still getting the price down, which he wants to do, is going to be challenging. But then also the logistics, the flight time may be 30 minutes, but how long does it take you to get to where the departure? And, you know, it's probably only going to be between two big cities. So you might be having, you might have a long drive on either end of that, you know.
Yeah.
And
there's going to be
the whole process of going through security and getting on board the ship. And who knows what kind of safety procedures there are. And I wonder what kind of G-forces you're going to be subjected to, you know.
Ooh, yeah, the health risks.
Right.
Yeah.
So, the bottom line could be, you know, instead of, you know, a 20-hour flight to Australia, it's going to be, you know, a 12-hour ordeal, you know, with a really happy ride in the middle of it, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly.
A quick one.
Yeah. And is that worth $20,000 or whatever crazy price it's going to be? You know, because it's not going to be the price of a plane ticket.
No, it's not. Not for quite a long time. We talked about this, Steve. Jay and I were talking about this. And ultimately, I mean, the money that they would make from these very expensive tickets, you know, we've got first class and above, you know, airlines that were, you know, $40,000. People will pay to be uber comfortable on a long flight. People will do the same thing for this, especially for the novelty once it's really safe. And the money that would garner would really help advance the technology and eventually make it commonplace. I mean, who knows how long that will take? That's a huge
if
huge
ever,
thing.
But even if it never becomes commonplace, if it always like yachts, right? I mean, yachts are never going to be commonplace. It's always going to be a luxury for the relatively rich. But as you say, that's okay if it subsidizes a commercial space program. And so here's the other component to this story. And that is that Elon Musk wants to use a new rocket system that SpaceX is developing called the BFR. Evan, you know what BFR stands for?
Big effort rocket.
Big blanking rocket.
Yeah, that's literally what
that's
it stands for.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I love that. He wants to develop the BFR as one rocket system that will do everything. It will put up satellites into orbit. It will resupply the International Space Station. It will take people to the moon. It will take people to Mars. And it will take people on intercity trips on Earth. So a really versatile, to say the least, rocket system, which is interesting. It's an interesting idea. It doesn't quite make sense when you think about it. Really?
No,
it doesn't.
We're going
to be using the same rocket to go to Hong Kong as freaking Mars?
Mars. Maybe with some modification. You have to have some modifications.
No.
The basic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The
core.
Inside.
Right.
So,
the core technology, I suppose.
So this is the vision. So it's a big rocket, right? It's a big effing rocket. So if you're on Earth, it won't initially carry passengers. This is, you know, the plan. The plan is that it will carry cargo, right? So the intercity flights will be pioneered just shipping cargo. And then once you build up an adequate safety record, then you could start shuttling people. But so it's really big. It's got a lot of cargo space or passenger space. But the key to its versatility is not that it's modifiable, but that it could be refueled in flight. So, for example, if you're going to go to the moon, you use up your fuel to get into orbit, then you refuel, and then you get another boost to the moon, and then maybe you could get yet another boost to Mars. You know, so
you got to get all that fuel into orbit.
So yes, you do.
There's a lot of infrastructure, a lot of pieces to this puzzle.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty naive in a lot of ways, though, because, I mean, I like the idea of focusing on a specific type of rocket that you can use in a lot of different ways. But I don't think you're ever going to remove specialty rocketry, things like ion propulsion, or how about this? How about nuclear rocket engines? Hello. You know, the rockets he's talking about are never going to match them in many different aspects and advantages. So I think, maybe ultimately we'll have a handful, a few different types of primary rockets. But some of these tasks are so different that you can't just say, you throw this rocket at it and only one rocket. I don't think it's realistic at all.
Right. You need the right tool for the right job, it would seem.
Yes, right. Yes, but if in Musk's defense, and I think you know he does have an answer to that objection.
Really, he addresses that specifically.
Yes, okay. And you know I think he's earned the right to at least be listened to. I mean, obviously not everything, not every vision works out, but I love the fact that he's just trying, that he's thinking about it and trying to do something interesting. So
sure, that alone is
the
cool.
concept here. Is to get costs down. And he said there's this system, the BFR system, will keep costs down primarily because it's one rocket. So you don't need a factory that or a system that accommodates different attachments or different boosters or whatever, or different tanks. It's all one identical rocket, and that allows for mass production. That allowed, and that is all about cost containment. And if, yes, sure, you might lose something in terms of being the precisely correct tool for the job, but you gain something in the fact that the cost can be reduced because you're focusing the company's entire research and production on perfecting and tweaking the hell out of one rocket. The other thing, cost containment feature is that the BFR, other than the fuel that you have to add to it, it's 100% reusable. So there are no booster rockets which are disposable. There are no external tanks which are disposable. It's 100% reusable. There's no stages which get left in orbit and become space junk. That's it. You got the rocket and its fuel, and that's it. So even though you may be using more of a rocket than you need for a particular job, so what? It may be a bigger rocket than you need to get a satellite into orbit, but that really, you make up the extra cost because the whole system is reusable and is mass produced.
Well, sure. I mean, you get the efficiencies of scale and reusability. Sure, that's a huge advantage, and if we just focus on that, that could take us a long, long way, and that's wonderful. And yeah, we should probably be doing something like that. But I do not think by any means that we should be focusing purely on chemical energy. It's just too inefficient. Maybe we could conceivably do that for a generation, but at some point, and I think we should do it sooner rather than later, we need to be focusing on non-chemical energy rocketry just for the efficiencies and the amounts of fuel required and things like that. I mean, chemical energy, as we know, is just
inefficient. That could be
huge. Think of the delay. It took us to get 10 years to get to Pluto. Why? Because carrying all that extra fuel is just so expensive. And that's going to go down eventually as well. But you can't deny the superiority of some of these other different types of rocket.
But Bob, you say we. Who are you talking about? Is that something NASA should be doing? Should we be letting NASA innovate new technology? But SpaceX is about making it cost effective and commercial, not necessarily innovating. So
that's fine. That's fine. Bring chemical rockets to their apotheosis of their technology, and that's great. But as long as some of the big boys, I guess, like NASA or some of the other space industries are focusing on the sci-fi, the stuff that's really going to take over in the future, that's great. I mean, we need it is ridiculous that we've got we made amazing progress with nuclear engines in the 60s, and then they passed that law, no nukes in space, and that just killed it.
All right.
It just kills me to think what we would have right now. We could conceivably be getting to Jupiter and the outer solar system in a fraction of the time and a fraction of the cost that we're doing it now, and I just hate to see that fall by the wayside. But I have no problem with Musk just working on that stuff, fine, as long as we realize there's going to be some more types of rockets we're going to need as well.
Right, but he's about he's prioritizing minimizing cost because he thinks for commercial, space industry, that's critical. And, this is the way he's choosing to do that. And whatever, it's his company, it's his vision. At least he's thinking about it. It makes sense from a certain point of view. We'll have to see how it works, maybe at the end of the day, he'll realize, you know what, I guess we need two rockets. You know, we need like a small rocket and a big rocket. And with those, we could pretty much do everything we need. Who knows, you know, how right. this will work out. But for now, he's going to phase out, you know, the Dragon and the Falcon, everything. And just everything's going to be the BFR. That's going to be SpaceX's one and only rocket for a while. And if, hey, if that brings the cost down of getting into space and getting to the moon, great. He still is optimistic about going to Mars. I think that's where he's off the rails because, you know, yeah. I think he's talking about just the rocket technology. Okay, that's not the limiting factor. The limiting factor is radiation. Yeah, the shielding and the infrastructure and the resources and what are people going to be eating when they're there. You know, it's right. more of that stuff, not just, you know, building a rocket that can get to Mars. So, but whatever. But I'm glad he's doing what he's doing. Love it.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. All right, guys, wait, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Pamela Gay. Pamela, welcome back to the SGU.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Yeah, it's been a little while since we've had you on the show. And we're having you on because you want to tell us about one of your new projects, CosmoQuest Citizen Science Projects. Tell us about this.
We just launched a new project called Image Detective that asks you to look at Earth for a change. So instead of looking up, we're looking down. And it turns out we live on a pretty amazing world if...
That's what I hear.
Well, yeah, if you look from 250 miles up, can't see any of the garbage.
So what are people going to be looking for?
So this is a project to go through and label astronaut photos. Over the past couple of decades, basically, we've had astronauts from 18 different nations up on board the International Space Station. And these men and women are super busy. And part of their day-to-day duties is taking pictures of our planet and its nearby environment. So they're getting photos of the Earth, of the moon, of the aurora. Occasionally they pick up comets as they swing by the planet and other amazing things. And as they're taking all of these photos, they're not labeling them. So we have this amazing repository of imagery that we can use to study our changing planet, and we can't yet because we need people like your audience and you to go online and help us label what's in the photos and play this amazingly difficult game of Where's Waldo to try and locate these images on maps of the Earth.
Oh, I see. Now, I have to say, though, that sounds like something... That might
AI,
be,
Steve?
Yeah, it might be a good job for unstructured data AI type of software. Like, can a computer do this?
You would think, but right now, not quite. And the issue is we don't know what angle any of these photos are taken at because the astronauts are sort of free-floating. And so sometimes they're looking out over the limb of the Earth, and sometimes they're looking straight down, and sometimes the photos are out of focus, and sometimes everything is horribly warped because they're looking at the planet at a weird angle. And then how do you differentiate clouds from snow, from water glistening? And all of these different things that our human mind is able to sort out. It turns out computers, they're just not quite there yet.
Bet you they will be, though, in 5 to 10 years, right?
It's true, but what do we do in the intervening? We're trying to get a handle as much as we can, and those computers will need training data sets. So the holy grail is to create that data set that these computers will be able to use once the software is good enough.
Well, plus that has the obvious advantage of getting people involved in participating in science. And,
it's
you know,
true.
for all the greatness that computers might be able to do in sorting all this stuff, you know, it gives people a chance to get their hands in on this.
That is all entirely true. And beyond that, these images allow us to create a catalog that will be useful to journalists trying to find that picture of North Korea because they want to look and see what are the agricultural zones. It's useful for people trying to find that photo of last spring when all the flowers bloomed in the California desert. It's useful for seeing how is it that, well, we have this amazing grid of square, circular, rectangular farms all across the United States. And those circles, that's where the irrigation is happening with the sprinkler systems. And what if you're a kid and you're trying to understand how often are farmers using this one particular sprinkler system, or you're an agricultural scientist trying to understand that? You can't answer any of these questions until the images are labeled.
Now, this is the same software basically that you're using to also have citizens map the moon and Mars and Mercury. Is that right?
This is our citizen science builder. With this particular app, we've had to add new features. We now have the ability to drop a Google map because it's Earth. You can't really do the same thing with other worlds. We have the ability to drop a Google map in the background. And one thing that we haven't done since back in the days of having our ICE Investigator project is have little checkboxes that people could check to indicate what's in the image. Here, we're asking people to click a checkbox saying, here be glaciers, here be lakes, this image has lightning, and this image has cities. And so it's this multi-step process where we ask people to go through and first identify, do they see space or only Earth? What are the water features? What are the land features? What are the man-made features? And then if it's just Earth, where is it on Google Maps?
So Pamela, I have a question. How are the people who are going to be doing this able to verify the information that they are going to be plugging in?
So what we do is we get up to 15 different people to look at every image. And we assume that mistakes, for the most part, are unique, whereas the people who are getting the right answer will all get the same right answer. So we literally do the law of averages, and we look to see, do five people all see a glacier, or does only one while everyone else sees desert?
Okay, so there will be more than one set of eyes, certainly, on all of these photographs.
Yes. Yes, otherwise we have to worry about vandals and trolls and griefers. No, we rely on a community. We rely on many eyes gets more accurate results.
Yeah, you're crowdsourcing it, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, and using the consensus, which is, as you say, if someone gives a funny answer, 10 people are unlikely to give the same funny answer.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, you haven't slipped your family photos in there to get those images sorted too, have you?
No, sadly. So
I'd love to use this to sort through my like 20,000 personal pictures that I've taken over the last 10
years. He's not kidding. At least 20,000.
Yeah, I think we'd all love to do it, but not
yet.
We're
going to wait for AI. We need AI for that. Right.
Yes.
5 to 10 years.
Or if I ever have a robot servant in my house, that will be one of their tasks. Go through all my photographs and label them for me, please.
Oh, my God.
Well, it is really all of our worst nightmares. We all have these hard drives, but I know my hard drive isn't going to produce publishable science. That's the difference here.
Yes.
And their view is better than any of our views have ever been. Like I said, they're 250 miles up.
Yeah, but I got some cool pictures on my cell phone. You haven't seen them.
But are they out of this world cool pictures?
Well, literally.
You'd be surprised. Okay, I get your point. Point taken.
What are some of the other projects, and what have they produced so far, like the Mars Mapper? How has that gone?
So Mars Mappers is still chewing away, and we're getting ready to swap out the data and move from our current project, which is looking for highly eroded sites on Mars, because those are the places that we're most likely to find recently revealed, basically fossilized organic materials. So just like here on Earth, you go to someplace like the chalk cliffs of Devon, where the hillside is quickly eroding away, to look for fossils. On Mars, you want to go to someplace that has fast erosion to find recently revealed material from the past that hasn't yet been blasted apart by the sun. We've been working on that for about 2 years now. We're about to retire that data set so that we can focus on getting science out of it. And we're going to replace it with new data sets that are looking to figure out how recently was there vulcanism on Mars, and how does the surface, well, tend to splatter when space throws rocks at the surface of Mars? So we're going to be looking at those ejecta blankets that get formed around craters. Moon Mappers continues. We're going to be adding new data sets and hopefully looking to do hazard maps for various future spacecraft. We also have projects to look at the fairly nearby asteroid Vesta, trying to map out this truly insane world to help us figure out just what is going on its surface. We also have a project to look at Mercury and try and tease apart which are the craters that were formed by rocks that came from the asteroid belt that just generally were flying around the solar system versus which are the craters that got formed when the formation of one of those first craters threw boulders all over the surface, creating secondary craters. So it's craters all the way down on Mercury, and we're trying to figure out, well, who is the criminal that formed which crater?
Neat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there seems to be a lot of these astronomy crowdsourcing projects. I've had fun with the the Galaxy Identifier.
Right.
That's a fun one. And then also there's one where it's looking at just the solar system, and you're just trying to identify moving things. I guess they're trying to find possible planetoids or dwarf planets or whatever.
Comets or spaceships.
And our project, our very first citizen science that we did with CosmoQuest was to look for Kuiper Belt objects out in the outer solar system. And there's actually about 500 people out there that now have their names attached to the discoveries of new icy objects in the outer solar system.
Oh, I want to do that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I did that for a while. I didn't find anything, though.
Wow.
It's luck of the draw. But good, like, there was like a million people looking at it, right?
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
It's like panning for gold.
Out of a million. Yeah. Worse even. But it's interesting, though. I mean, you know, you're just sitting around, you know, it's, you have an hour to kill, look at galaxies or Kuiper Belt objects or whatever.
And
you may get lucky.
And with our image detective program, you never know what you're going to find. I've found erupting volcanoes. I've found snow in the desert of Saudi Arabia, which I didn't even know was a thing that happened.
Whoa.
Yeah, our planet is amazing. And so I keep over and over changing my screen background just because I keep finding new and amazing astronaut photos.
Has anyone found any alien cities on the moon or Mars?
No, not yet.
None confirmed.
No buried spaceships?
Not yet. Well, we have found some partially buried spacecrafts, but they're kind of ours and the Russians.
Oh, I see. Cool. So, Pamela, tell our audience what your research is. What do you do? What's the primary focus of your research?
So I am actually a big data person. So my job is to try and figure out how to make it easier for scientists to figure out what is the meaning of all of these clicks that are being made by citizen scientists.
Yeah.
It's part of my job to go through and figure out how can people contribute in more and more meaningful ways and tease apart all of this different data? So I do stats and I do software, and we actually now have funding that's going to allow me to get back to my passion, which is actually studying variable stars, where we're going to be asking citizen scientists to go out and take images. And instead of analyzing images we give them, we're going to give them the software tools to analyze their own images and measure how the stars are changing night to night and how asteroids are moving through the sky. So I'm basically someone who programs computers in the name of science.
Yeah. And astronomy in general has moved in that direction. I mean, right? I mean, 100 years ago, astronomers looked through telescopes, and now they look at computer screens.
That is sadly true, although a lot of observers will take out their binoculars and walk around the dome at night looking for clouds and faint fuzzies in the sky with their own eyes.
Yeah.
But we do live on our computers. It's true.
Yeah. Same thing pretty much with everything. I'm a physician, right? I spend most of my day on the computer.
Yes.
That's just the way
it
is. Cool. And you're still doing a lot of podcasting.
Yeah. So we have Astronomy Cast getting recorded every Friday that both of us are in town. We move to other days of the week randomly. So watch our Twitter feed, Astronomy Cast. And we are still taking our audience on a fact-based journey through this universe where we keep just learning more and more and more. And this week, we're actually going to be talking about remote sensing and how it is that we learn about other objects without actually touching them, because there's certain things you don't want to touch because even human spacecraft are kind of germy. So we don't want to be out there touching Europa, for instance, because Europa may have life and we want to keep it safe, but still study Europa to find out just what might be out there.
That's why we crashed or burned up Cassini, right? We didn't
that's
want
right. to so
infect. Exactly. Like, exactly. And that was actually this amazing night of, and I don't know if it was accidental or not. With NASA, it's usually not. One of the very last images Cassini took was of the moon Enceladus as it set behind Saturn. And Enceladus is an icy world that appears to have a subsurface ocean that surrounds a warm core. And we believe that it's a habitable, potentially icy ocean. Mm-hmm. So we had to kill Cassini. We had to plunge it into the depths of Saturn's atmosphere and
save the
its
space
last
dolphins.
Goodbye. Yeah, its last goodbye was taking this image of the world it was protecting.
And so for our audience, if they want to participate in this cool citizen science project, you go to cosmoquest.org, right?
Cosmoquest.org.
Yep.
And this is our image detectives program. And if you're lazy, just go to cosmoquest.org/image detective.
Yeah. So, Pamela, you agreed to hang out with us after our discussion and do science or fiction with us. Are you ready?
I don't know if I can ever be ready for this, but I'll sure try.
Okay.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Now, there actually may be an astronomy news item in here, Pamela. Let's see. Here they are. Item number one. New observations of the star KIC 8462852 show that in addition to dimming, it also undergoes periods of brightening, a fact that disproves most current hypotheses about what is causing the changes to the star's brightness. Item number two. Scientists have developed a new nanomaterial that can directly convert seawater into electricity, essentially using the ocean as a giant battery. And item number three, researchers find in an international study that people distrust those of different political ideology more than of different race or religion. Okay, well, Pamela, as our guest, you have the distinct privilege of going first.
Oh, man. So all of these are deeply perplexing. That KIC license plate star that you mentioned, it's determined to disprove everything and anything, but I haven't kept up on reading about it.
Good.
But I'm at the point where I think I would believe anything about that star. It's just weird. The last one with researchers finding that people distrust those of different political ideology more than those of a different race or religion, I just don't know on that one, because with the Nobel Prizes coming out this week and the fact that they just keep giving them to white men tells me that there's this sort of tied in to race, religion, gender that I think would overcome politics. So... And I don't know what to make of seawater for electricity. People are always finding new ways to get electricity out of things. You just don't know if it's effective or not. So I'm going to go with I really think that race and religion are the things that matter more, and that three is false. The researchers find international study of people distrust people based on politics more.
That's
I just
fiction.
Can't believe that. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Evan.
These are impossible almost. Okay, so for the star, license plate star, I like that term, Pamela.
It's called Tabby Star, right?
Yeah.
Tabby Star. Okay. All right. Well, Tabby Star. In addition to dimming, it undergoes periods of brightening, and it disproves most current hypotheses.
Well, the one I have a problem with about this one is that this is one set of data. I mean, compared to a lot of other data that tells us otherwise. So I don't know about this one. This one, does it really throw the whole field into this sort of, you know, question mark? I'd be surprised at that. The second one, where they developed a nanomaterial that can directly convert seawater into electricity. Directly seawater into electricity using the ocean as a giant battery? Oh my gosh. If they did that, that's incredible. Wow. Seawater to electricity. So I think that one's wrong too. I think there's two fictions here. And then, of course, the last one you were talking about, Pamela. Distrusting those of different political ideology more than different race or religion. I agree with Pamela in that, you know, race and religion issues are omnipresent in a sense. Yes, political ideology as well. It's just so political ideology is trumping. Forgive me for using that. Trump has such a pall over everything nowadays that if it's a more recent study, then perhaps because of the mood, say, this sort of that has enveloped everybody in the current political climate, perhaps that had an effect on the results of the study. So maybe it's kind of a localized phenomenon in that way. Oh, gosh. I don't think any of these are science. Therefore, I think seawater.
Wow, dude.
Gosh, seawater to electricity is just wow. I don't see that. I don't see that. Using the ocean as a giant battery, that's like, don't you need intermediary steps in between? How do you get directly from seawater to electricity? I don't see it. I think that one's fiction.
Okay, and Bob.
Yeah, that's the Tabby Star thing. I guess at this point, little is would surprise me. I mean, so Evan, it's not like the you mentioned something about the whole, that this might bring the whole, I forget the exact word you use, but it's really
it reads that disproves most current hypotheses about what's causing the change.
It's hypotheses about what's causing the change to this specific star. So it's not like it's throwing out all variable star.
Just the star in particular.
It's this star, but there is some cause. So, that one's just so crazy. But the other one's having even more trouble with. Yeah, the whole ocean is a battery. That just sounds way too convenient. The one about distrusting people. Yeah, I mean, people distrust everyone for stupid reasons. I'm thinking that what I've seen the past year in terms of people's reactions to other people and their ideas because they were not of the same political ideology. It's really just been so disgusting. And I know basing attitudes and beliefs based on race and religion is disgusting as well. But this has been in my face so much in the past year that I'm going to say that one, it wouldn't surprise me. I'll just put it that way. That wouldn't surprise me. So I'll go with Evan and say that the ocean is a giant battery is fiction.
Okay. So let's start with number one then, since you all agree on that one. New observations of the star KIC 8462852, otherwise known as Tabby Star, show that in addition to dimming, it also undergoes periods of brightening, a fact that disproves most current hypotheses about what is causing the changes to the star's brightness. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Oh yeah!
Yay!
Yeah, so I was wondering
what the hell.
Yeah, sort of, right. Yeah. So
sort of yay.
is it brightening in the infrared because it's a Dyson sphere? No.
Yes, Bob. Yes.
So yeah, just a reminder to our audience: Tabby Star or the license plate stars you heard first caught our attention in 2015. So stars will dim, like if planets pass in front of them. That's how we find, through transits. That's how we find some exoplanets. But even if a big Jupiter-sized, near like a hot Jupiter passes in front of a star, it dims by a teeny tiny amount. And this star was dimming by a significant amount, multiple percentage points.
20% or something?
Yeah, so nothing they could think of really could explain it. And then we're thinking maybe there's swarms of comets or maybe it ate a planet or whatever. There's all kinds of theories as to what might be causing the variability in this star. Well, a recent review of observations of this star, some going back to 2006, found that there were periods. Not only is the star dimming over time, so there's the variability in the star, then there's this all this just slow dimming of the star, 2% since 2006, which is also crazy. You know, that it would, that's something else they can't explain. But there were periods where the star got brighter. So now we're not talking about the fluctuation in the brightness. We're talking about the steady dimming over the last 10 years. But actually, it went through periods of brightening as well as dimming. And that just threw out all of the hypotheses pretty much that the astronomers were coming up with to try to explain the dimming. So this is almost sending them back to the drawing board. Yeah, so it just, the star, this is, every time I read a new study, a new update on this star, I mean, Pamela, tell me know if you have the same reaction, it seems like it's getting more enigmatic. We actually have less of an idea what the hell's going on with this star.
This star is kind of why we do science. It's because we don't know everything and we want to. And this one refuses to let us. It just, it's like, nope, no understanding for you.
Yeah, it's just really, really weird. So something new and interesting has to be going on with this star. And, you know, I think we said there's like, there's billions of stars out there. So really rare things, we're going to come across really rare things occasionally. Who knows what the hell could be going on here. And of course, there's that contingent who's going to be a holdout for saying that it's aliens. But that's, you know, what they say. Every time we can't immediately explain some astronomical phenomenon, it's aliens.
It's so funny you say that because I just finished a fantastic book series called The Bobiverse.
Yes.
And oh my God, I fell in love with that series so hard. But I can't say it because it's going to give away a huge plot thing. Never mind.
No spoilers.
But really everyone can't. Should go out and read I Am Legion, I Am Bob. Silliest name, awesome book series.
Oh my God. And if you're amenable, don't read it. Listen to it. The narrator is fantastic. I'm going to search out other books that he's read just because it's his voice. I love it so much.
Mm. Very Bob-iverse, geeky. Huh?
Yes, and of course that was a big draw for me, of course. Okay. Cool technology. Very cool technology.
Right. Which we can't even say why you brought it up, but okay. No. Let's go on to number two. Scientists have developed a new nanomaterial that can directly convert seawater into electricity, essentially using the ocean as a giant battery. Pamela, you think this one is science. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. And this one is... The fiction.
Ooh, oh, yes. Man.
Oh, sorry, Pamela. Yeah, this was a tough one. So this is based on a real news item.
I wish it was science.
And I had to make it different enough that it was wrong. So they did develop a new nanomaterial that does convert seawater, but not into electricity. It converts it into hydrogen. It's a photocatalyst. Okay. It uses sunlight. It's powered by sunlight, and it essentially catalyzes the conversion of water into hydrogen and oxygen.
Nice. Wow.
Yeah, so this is one, and there's lots of other new, because I also did the background research to make sure this one was fiction. There's a lot of processes that could turn seawater into hydrogen peroxide or other ways of turning it into hydrogen, basically trying to develop a higher energy molecule out of the water so that you could then use it as fuel. Because like hydrogen peroxide, you could make into fuel. Hydrogen itself is a fuel. Remember the hydrogen economy? So,
yes.
which still may happen. You know, I think it's just going to take a lot longer than anybody thought, but it still really is a viable idea once we could work out all the technological hurdles. And this is one. So if we could, you know, cheaply and to scale, convert lots of seawater into hydrogen just using solar energy. It's a really convenient way and a very efficient way of storing solar energy. You know, hydrogen is an energy storage medium. It's not a source of energy. It's just a way of storing it. And then, of course, you convert it back you can convert it to electricity by combining it back with oxygen. Not that efficient as energy storage devices go. Batteries are more efficient. Pumped hydro is more efficient, but it's not bad. The big convenience is that it could be easily transported and it could be very portable. But that's the other big hurdle, is finding ways of storing lots of hydrogen in a portable, light, and safe way that can be released quickly enough to run a car. We don't have that yet. If someone develops that, then the hydrogen economy could literally then take off. But this could be very meaningful, you know, if it eventually gets plugged into, you know, a hydrogen economy. And then of course, at the end, gotta love it. This is the scientist's name is Yang Yang. And he said, Yang's team, they're now working on a way to scale up fabrication. I love reading that term, scale up. That always seems to be in the last paragraph of every news item like this. It's like this it's a very non-trivial issue and often is the deal breaker, you know.
Yeah, right.
These technologies don't scale up. That's why we never see them. You know, that's not a trivial problem. The breakthrough here really, so there were previous materials that could turn water into hydrogen, that could photocatalysts, but they would use they worked in the lab with purified water, which is a problem because purifying water to that degree is an expensive process and is really limiting. But this just works on raw seawater, which would be a huge advantage.
Oh, gosh. Abundance.
Yeah. Because, we happen to have a lot of it. So anyway, I don't know if this will ever come into any kind of industrial use, but it was an interesting breakthrough. There are, by the way, seawater-based batteries. This is a very new technology that is being developed. We don't really have anything usable at this point in time. This is ongoing research, a lot of it taking place in South Korea. But it is possible to use the sodium in seawater as a battery medium, and it has the big advantage of being abundant and super cheap. But the downside is that it doesn't hold that much energy, right? With batteries, there's always a deal breaker. But of course, this isn't just using the ocean. You have to store this in a container and charge it. You know, the energy isn't already there. It's, you know, you have to store the energy in it, but it doesn't release that much energy very quickly. So you're not going to be driving your car on seawater batteries. But that kind of battery could be useful for grid storage, because again, for grid storage, it could be huge. Doesn't matter. It could
be
heavy. Doesn't really matter. I mean, relatively huge. You could have a lot of seawater in a vast container, and that, you know, if that could store enough energy to be useful to stabilize the grid, who knows? It still could be useful for grid storage. I don't think it's going to be powering your iPhone anytime soon.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the energy density for that.
But what you're actually telling us is if we want to cure racism, we need everyone to be one political party.
Right. So, so let's go on number three. Researchers find in an international study, so this isn't it just the U.S. guys, that people distrust those of different political ideology more than of different race or religion. That one is science. So the research paradigm they were using here is a trust paradigm. So here's the study. You have two people, and they are in separate rooms, so they don't know what decisions the other person is making. And they do it with real money. So Evan, let's say you're person A. I give you $20.
Woo-hoo.
And you can give any amount of that to person B in the next room. And you know that person B is going to get whatever amount of money you give them, they will get three times that much. So if you give them $10, they get 30.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could return to you any amount of money that they choose. So the question is,
so
you could theoretically give them all $20. It'll be tripled to 60, and then you both get $30, right? So you would get, you'd get more money. So if you had 100% trust in that other person, you would give them $20, because then you would know they would be giving you back 30 and you'd get more money.
If you
had zero trust in them, you would give them no dollars. You'd keep all 20 for yourself, right?
Yeah, you're right. Yes.
Yeah. So that's the paradigm. So the question is, how much do you trust that other person, quantified by how much money do you give them, trusting that they will give you back some because they're going to get triple whatever you give them? Okay. So then each person knows who the other person is, but they're isolated in the decision-making process. So the question was, in this paradigm, do people trust or distrust the other person more if they are of the same political party, right? So would a Democrat trust a Republican more or less, or will they trust somebody of a different race or a different gender or different religion? And they studied this in the U.S. and in Spain and in a couple other countries, in Basque Country of Spain and what was the other one? In the United Kingdom and Belgium. And it didn't matter. And everywhere they tested it, that the people trusted someone of the other political party less than somebody of another race or religion. Isn't that interesting?
Wow. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah, so a political party is more divisive. and there really wasn't, the race wasn't really even a big factor at all. It really didn't affect the amount that people trusted other people.
That's awesome.
That's a silver lining.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. But left, right, whoa. Really didn't trust, didn't trust people of another political party.
I wonder what the results would have been if they said one person was an atheist.
Yeah, that's true. That was true. All right, well, you could apply the same paradigm to a lot of other questions. Like, I wonder about their homosexual or transgender.
Sexuality,
yeah,
sure.
I think atheist would be a huge factor. Bob, you're right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see. I mean, this is the kind of study where you could do it with a lot of different parameters. But in the ones that they tested, and the one that really they were focusing on race, they also did religion, but they were kind of surprised that political party was more of a factor in trust than was race. So could be a sign of progress, could be a sign of how divisive the world is becoming, you know, not just the U.S. Political ideology. Yeah. Is this an internet phenomenon? You know, when you think about it, you could explain all of this based on social media, because the more people are exposed to other people, the more they accept them. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the more divisive our opinions get. You know what I mean? So we might be more comfortable with people who look different than us because we're being exposed to them more. But if you're in a different echo chamber than we are, you're the enemy. Right?
So dreaded echo chambers, man.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
This is the new world now with social media.
Oh boy.
We've seen it. I mean, Pamela, I don't know if you have any personal experience with this as well, but we all know people personally that, man, if you're on the other side of that echo chamber divide, they're different freaking world.
Oh, I think we all do. It's the problem of, given our constantly changing economy, our ability to judge is based on our detailed understanding of economic theory, and economics isn't a purely logical science at this point. So you also have to interpolate, and we each build in our different set of preferred assumptions interpreting what's going on. And one person is going to blame the past president for what's going on now, and another is going to blame the current. And this just leads to, why don't you understand? And some people just don't want to try and understand. Let's face it, 2017 is a year that is causing all of us to wake up several times a week and go, why did I wake? I regret all my life choices. Why am I listening to the news?
Yeah, I think it's even worse than that, to be honest with you, because you're talking about different interpretations. And what's really, I think, changed a lot in the last couple of years quite a bit is that people have different facts. People are basing their opinions on different sets of facts. You know, it's like not even just a different interpretation of a shared set of facts. That's like a 10-year-old problem. But now it's, people just make up their own facts. You know, they're being presented a package of alternative facts that are curated for their specific ideology. And that's their reality.
And I don't know how to deal with that. I really don't.
It's a new problem. I don't know that any of us really know how to deal with it. You know, you talk with somebody, we've had these conversations with people that we know personally, and they're just like, no, that's not true. Here's what's true. And they tell a completely different version of reality. It's just amazing. Well, we'll survive somehow. We'll figure it out. All right, Evan, give us a quote to close out the show.
Scientific literacy is an intellectual vaccine against the claims of charlatans who would exploit ignorance. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, cool. It's a very, very Sagan-esque statement. But as we said recently, though, while I think that's true as far as it goes, I would no longer say that scientific literacy is enough. You need to give a booster shot of critical thinking. Otherwise, the one vaccine of scientific literacy just doesn't cut it.
Oh, very good. Way to take it to the next
level,
Steve.
Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you. All right. Well, Pamela, thanks for hanging out with us for so long. I really appreciate it. A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really always enjoy this. I'm always glad to come back and talk science with you guys.
Yeah, you'll have to come back and get your science or fiction record up a little bit.
It's true. It's true. It is nice to know, though, that there is hope on uniting humanity, even if it is behind a political theory.
Right, right. Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, Steve.
Thanks,
thank
Steve.
You.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.